3, 2, 1.
It's like an architect building a house. Your engineer has to build a foundation or your house is going to blow down. To me, that endless dig and that endless, the fact that there's still more to discover is hugely fascinating. Graphic designers and art directors tell other people's stories. We don't tell our stories. My job, good graphic design or good art direction or good creative direction is invisible.
Hey everyone, I'm Noor Tagori and this is The Process. And welcome back to The Process. This week's episode, we are going into the process of letting your work speak for itself. So I thought the perfect person to talk to about this would be a creative director. Now, if you're not familiar with what a creative director does, that will be defined for you shortly. But think of it for now as a visual storyteller. And one of my favorite visual storytellers is Ruba Abu Ni'ma. She's the creative director of Revlon. She used to be at Shiseido, Bobbi Brown, and Elle Magazine. She just has such a wealth of knowledge in this space, so I can't wait for you to hear this conversation. Were you always into art?
Yes, I was always into art. But I didn't realize I was always into art until much later. I know that sounds really weird, right? For example, when I lived in Brussels. I did my high school years in Brussels, and we lived in this big house. And I was, you know, between the age of, 12 and 17. I did not, you know, I was very obsessed with the electronic things in my mother's kitchen, the can opener and the juicer and stuff like that. And I just like loved them. And then when I went to college, I took them with me, even though I didn't need any of those things. And then I was just very obsessive about those specific ones. Not all of them, but
did
specific.
Did she ask why though?
No, they just thought, whatever. And then there were a couple of like bread baskets, which I still have in my kitchen, that I was very obsessed with. And then much later, many years later, I realized that those specific things were actually designed by Dieter Rams. And Dieter Rams being one of the greatest industrial designers in the world, they were all Braun products, and Braun was very ubiquitous in Europe. You could just go anywhere and buy it. So I clearly had a connection without knowing to design. And I didn't understand what my connection was. I just knew that I thought this object was really beautiful. I didn't know who designed it, I didn't even know it was designed. I didn't know that such a thing existed that you know, some great industrial designer designed this thing that made orange juice. And I think that's a very European philosophy. It's a very European phenomena, you know, with cars and architecture. And I think the Americans, God help me for saying this, haven't quite caught up to that. American cars are just ugly. I mean, I don't even recognize it. I don't know what an American car is, but you cannot compare.
I don't know what an American car is either.
I don't think you can compare an American car to a Ferrari or a Maserati or an Aston Martin or a Porsche or a BMW or a Mercedes. None of those are comparable. And there is a history of design and a history of industrial design in Europe that simply doesn't exist today.
Well,
in America, I mean, today or ever.
But do you think that people, Europe or America or wherever, typically recognize design in common things? Because even when you just mentioned the orange juice, the juicer or the can opener, you don't consciously think there was design put into this.
But that's the problem. I think Europeans do design things for the home. The Japanese do, the Germans do, the Danes do, the Italians do. Italian industrial design is exquisite. I think that the Swiss, I mean, there you can't, even the British on a very, I mean, they invented all sorts of art movements they invented the Industrial Revolution. I think that America makes things, but it doesn't consider the design.
So what's
with exceptions, I'm sure there.
Is it intention?
I think America is about making things very quickly and then getting rid of them very quickly. Whereas the Europeans make things and you keep them.
And you recognize that later in life?
I recognize that later because I didn't know what design was. I didn't know what graphic design was. I didn't know what industrial design was. I didn't know what those terms meant. And I didn't understand that there was that there was intent in making things. And I remember very distinctly, I was probably about, I would say 10 years old, maybe 11 years old, and I went to a bookstore with my mother. We were living in London at the time, and I was looking at the books, and I found this book, which is still here somewhere on the bookshelf. I've moved, I will never get rid of it. It's not a great book, and it's called The Contemporary Decorative Arts. And I opened up this book, and it was kind of an overview of the history of design, contemporary design, modern design. And it was, there was a little bit of fashion, a little bit of furniture, and a little bit of painting, and a little bit of industrial design. It was a little bit of everything. And all of a sudden, my world changed, because I was like, holy shit, all this stuff is, this is design. And all these things mean something. And all these things were made by people, and all these things have a history. And I begged my mother to buy me this book, begged her. She was like looking at me like I had two heads, because we were supposed to be in the children's book department. I was with my brother
How
and sister.
Old were you?
I think I was like 10 or 11. And I was like, please buy me this book. And she was like, okay. She finally bought it. And at the time, it was probably very expensive. And I was just very obsessive about this book. The images that were used, I wish I would have looked for it, actually.
We should probably pull it after.
It might be over there somewhere. I might be over there, actually.
There's another bookshelf.
Yeah. So I realized that there was something happened. There was something in the world that was contemporary art that encompassed more than just a painting in a museum. And that kind of changed my world. And the other thing that changed my world is we had a neighbor that lived two doors down who was a graphic designer. And that was the first time I ever heard the term graphic designer. He was much older. I was 10 and he was probably in his, I would say, mid-20s.
And where was this?
This is in London. This is when we were living in London. And I would go up to his bedroom that was his studio and watch him design. And he was a commercial graphic designer, and he did a lot of work for department stores at the time, like Selfridges, and designing bags and then designing logos. And it was all done by hand. It was with rotary pens and ink. And I couldn't get enough of it. I was like, this is what I'm going to do in my life. I'm going to be a graphic designer. And that's all I cared about. From that point forward, that was my goal. And then my parents didn't really understand what that meant and didn't really understand how that kind of translated into real life. And so I had to go through this very academic, rigorous school, you know, the baccalaureate that we just talked about. And as soon as I was done, I'm like, I'm out. I'm going to art school, and this is what I'm going to do. And I think my parents thought it was sort of amusing in a way, and it's kind of funny. And, you know, and there was kind of, I also think there was this thing about, we're just going to let her do what she wants. But at the same time, you know, she's going to get married and have kids, and who cares what she does in the end. I don't think that anybody at that time perceived it as a career. Mm. And I don't think my parents, I think my mom still doesn't know what I do for a living. In all honesty, I think she likes to say, like, where's your name? Where'd they put your name? And then if she sees my name, she's like, okay, that's cool.
Okay.
But she doesn't really have an understanding of what it took for my name to get there.
Right. Well, okay, so explain to us what you do. So you are a creative director, but define what that is without using the words creative or director or direction.
Well, I'm a visual storyteller. I solve a problem. And because I work in the very commercial world, I don't have a blank canvas where I just can just create whatever I want. The world I live in doesn't work that way. I have there's a need, and I have to solve the need. And I work in advertising, so I sell product to people. I mean, I do it. I've only ever done it in the fashion and beauty industry. I've never really done it in the more mass industries, because I just don't get them and I don't care.
Well, what does creative direction even look like in those industries? Because anytime I think of that job, I always think about fashion and beauty. You don't think about it in a less colorful space?
It exists. I just don't want to know. I don't want to be a part of it.
I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, just I don't know how to do it. Like, I could never work in a big ad agency where I'm working on like the yogurt account. I just wouldn't know how to sell a yogurt to somebody because I don't care.
Well,
yogurt.
So then what is your tie to
so
fashion
what,
and
beauty? I think I've just always been, I mean, fashion and beauty, fashion is an art that you put on your body, and beauty is paint that you put on your face. It's all tied back to art. I think I mean, yogurt is an art if you've designed the packaging and if you've created. I mean, again, in Europe, they actually make beautiful packaging. You walk through a supermarket in Switzerland, it's like going through a museum. I mean, it's very considered. It's very beautifully designed. There's also huge consideration for the environment. I mean, they've been thinking about their environment for 20 years, whereas we're only just starting to really think about it. I mean, I'll never forget, I was in a supermarket in Switzerland 15 years ago, and at the end of the cash wrap, they have all these recycle bins where you can just unpackage all of your stuff at the supermarket, so you take it home without having to do that at home. So everything is so beautifully, and also there's very little packaging happening in Europe, whereas over here we overpackage and we cellophane. I mean, the fact that we've just banned plastic bags in New York this week is insane to me. But I also don't understand what that means, because everywhere that I've gone, they've handed me a plastic bag, so I still don't get what that means.
Right.
But you couldn't get a plastic bag to save your life in most countries of Northern Europe right now.
Yeah, I've noticed that. And, well, so to talk about beauty and fashion, do you think it's more about the act of expression in that sense that draws you to it?
I think it's, in terms of what it means artistically, I didn't even answer your question about what is a creative director.
I think you did.
Well,
it's
a creative director.
Storyteller?
Well, it's a visual storyteller, but it's also what's very important. As a creative director, you have to bring together a team of people to deliver a message. That's what it is. And it's funny, I actually hate the two words creative director. And when people ask me what I do for a living, I tell them I'm a graphic designer, because that is my trade. And I believe that everybody should have a trade. You have to start with a trade. It doesn't matter what it is. You can be an illustrator. But I believe everybody has to be tactile. And I get probably a dozen DMs a week with people who ask me, kids, very young kids, how do I become a creative director like you? I want to be a creative director. It's kind of it's a thing. It's a word. I mean, I think Urban Outfitters made a hoodie that said creative director, which I want to buy, but I can't find it because I want to just walk around wearing it. But becoming a creative director is a long, drawn out process. And what it does is you've developed your skill to such a degree that you're able to bring other people into the fold and mentor them and allow them to do what they do best, so that whatever the end product is it a film, is it a package design, is it an advertising campaign, is it a magazine, is it photography, whatever that is, the group of people get together and make that happen. And the creative director is the lead in terms of bringing the right people together. That's what a creative director is. So a 20-year-old kid who doesn't know what's required in order to get the end result can't be a creative director until they learn a skill. So my response to them is, go learn a trade. Make something with your hands. Be tactile. And we don't learn tactility because we're sitting at computers all day. And I think, as much as I love the computer and I love sitting in, I'm very techie and I've had a Mac since 19, I don't even know, 88, I think, before anybody in this room was born, probably. So I have been very, very into developing computer skills and you know, a lot of people my age, and I'm relatively old, don't know how to use a computer. Just kind of stopped at one point. They're like, oh, this is a scary thing. And I did the exact opposite. I'm like, wait, hold up. I'm going to dive into this, and it's going to become my tool for working. But I still have a skill. Like when I go into software, InDesign, for example, all of the terms that are inside this piece of software relate back to 100 years and how we used to lay things out by hand. And I won't get all technical and stuff, but I don't think the kids these days understand why we call a gutter in the middle of a book, or why we refer to typesetting as leading or kerning. Like, nobody knows what these terms come from, but they come from real you know, we used to use lead in order to set type.
For people who are asking you these questions, why is knowing this so important? When people are like, oh, well, we have the internet, we have access to all these things, I can just, you know, at the click of a button find this, and I can still, because you can still get really far without knowing why a gutter is called a gutter, but why should we?
We should because we can work better, because you can understand how to, if you only have information that's on the surface, you can only work on the surface. And the problem I have is a lot of people do work on the surface. And a lot of people are very successful working on the surface. I think that's finite. I think you can only take it so far, and then people see through the bullshit.
Okay, let's talk about this. I'm actually very passionate about this because I think that you're right, and we see so many. I'm passionate about this right now because I saw an article this morning about how so many of these, you know, internet companies are kind of imploding because they were built very, you know, I mean, they did really well, they grew really fast, but on more of a surface level, and we're seeing the repercussions of this now. How have you, you know, having the experience of this used to be your internet when you first started out, and seeing how people work today, how is that? Like, was that obvious to you? This was obviously going to happen because, you know, the foundation wasn't laid the way it should have been?
No, it wasn't obvious to me. I always thought that everybody was going to know their skill. I always thought that I was going to work with people who knew what I knew. And it's actually, I know it sounds weird, right? It's very shocking to me that people are in the industry and successfully in the industry that don't know basic things about my industry. And that to me is, and I actually take it upon myself as often as I can to teach. So, you know, and it's laborious, but I teach, you know, I go to an editing suite and I edit film commercials. I'm actually going there after this. And when I first started working with them, you know, we would have to set supers over film, you know, that address whatever message we're trying to get. So the editor would type in whatever super it is, which is, you know, our new lipstick or our new whatever. And they would be like, okay, here you go. And I'd be like, but hold on a second, what are you talking about? We have to kern this, we have to set this, we have to fix the line break, we have to center it or rag write it. And there was no knowledge of that whatsoever. So it's sort of people come into the editing as, well, we're going to cut and dice and slice this film and get all the bits and pieces in it. But that extra layer of, well, if you're going to put a sentence on top of this in this film, that sentence needs to be typeset properly. But they don't have typesetters in film editing companies. Or they will have graphic designers, but those graphic designers do motion because that's what you need in film. So there are all these missing bits and pieces that people don't see. But then I've worked with advertising agencies. We brought them into various brands that I've worked with. And there are young art directors that come in that are sort of won awards and have sort of fluffed up their feathers. And they don't know the basics of graphic design. And so sometimes I get really angry and I just become condescending because I'm like, I'm sorry, fuck you. Or sometimes I'm like, you know, sit down and let's talk about this. So, and it just depends on the person and how much they're willing to ingest.
Right.
But I never, ever, ever let it go. I just never let it go.
Well, so to your average consumer who's watching or listening to this right now, and they're the person that you are selling this product to, when they watch this or listen to this and say, well, like, I wouldn't notice the difference.
But they would. And I'll tell you, I knew you were going to say that. And people say that to me all the time. It's very subliminal. It's as simple as, if you don't space your letters correctly, you actually can't read it on the screen. So your consumer might be like, oh, I kind of understood what it said. And I've done the tests. With the editors that I work with, they see the difference. The sentence can't be read if it's not typeset properly. You need the right amount of space, the right amount of negative and positive space between letters, so that when you're standing away from it or you're looking at it on your phone, you can act. So it's actually a technical problem. So yes, your average consumer doesn't understand what it is that we do on the back end, but it does absolutely create a different type of message, a more readable message, if we do it right. It's like an architect building a house. Your engineer has to build a foundation or your house is going to blow down, right?
Right.
But most people don't think about the foundations of this house. This building here is 100 years old. There is a foundation. that is keeping this building from falling down. Mm-hmm. Most people walk into this building, don't think about that. There are walls here that make sure that the ceiling doesn't fall down. That's the fundamentals of graphic design, of proper typesetting. You don't necessarily have to think about it, but when it's there, it does its job.
If someone were to ask you why do you do what you do, how would you answer that?
I love what I do. I absolutely love, I don't know how to do anything else. I can't add. I'm terrible at anything that's business related. I don't know how to do an Excel spreadsheet. I don't know how to use Word. So I can't do anything else but do this.
Do you personally ever wear makeup or use the products that you're selling?
That's a trick question. I mean, is that a trick question?
Because I want to gear that towards like, it's so interesting to me. I see a lot of people in the creative field who are, you know, responsible for the messaging and the images and all of that, who like personally choose not to, but that doesn't mean like you don't believe in what you're putting out.
I believe that makeup makes you look better. So it does. If you
and
look
you're perfect.
No. I'm far from perfect. I'm also not young, and I see the aging process in myself. Like, I am seeing myself age. And it's a hard process because we have these unbelievably impossible standards of beauty that we all adhere to. And these standards of beauty, and I've yelled and screamed about these standards of beauty for decades, even being in the beauty industry.
Yeah.
And I mean, I could get into it, but it's very long-winded and very boring. It's socioeconomic. It's you know, the standards of beauty when the naturalists were deciding on the races a couple of hundred years ago, it was white men that were deciding what was considered beautiful versus what was considered not beautiful. And those standards of beauty have not changed. And they are beginning to change because the minorities and women who are not considered traditionally beautiful are standing up and saying, excuse me, what the fuck? But the standards of beauty are still very ingrained in both the industry and in women. So to answer your question, I very, very rarely wear makeup. I use skincare. I wake up. Also, I don't have time. You know, by the time I've gotten, you know, showered and dressed and figured out what I'm doing for the rest of the day, I don't have time to put makeup on. If I do, on the odd occasion, I'll wear a very kind of greasy and kind of fucked up eyeliner, and that pretty much covers it. I mean, I love nail polish because nail polish is fun, but I don't wear a lot of makeup, and I've never even thought about doing sort of all those injectables and stuff because they scare me. They actually, quite frankly, scare me. And I think that if I'm speaking about changing the standards of beauty and accepting who we are and being who we are, and I have to live by that.
Right.
So I try to as much as I possibly can. But I also think that people have to do what they're comfortable with. I think every woman has to do what she's comfortable with. And I don't think that makeup is bad. I think makeup is great. I think makeup does really good things. What I object to is when we start talking gibberish and gobbledygook and rubbish and saying, you know, this is a anti-aging cream because it's not. And this is a, you know, this is gonna, what do we say? Things like, you know, get rid of time or I don't know what
other,
and all that. Because it doesn't. It just doesn't. They don't. A moisturizer will moisturize. That's what it will do. But moisturized skin looks really nice.
It looks great.
It looks really good. It looks better than dry skin. So, I mean, I just wish that we could be a little bit more honest. Mm. But I also think that the consumer has to accept that.
But so, I mean, you're in a position where you are responsible for how these images are put out, mm-hmm. and how the messaging is consumed. And as somebody who has, I don't even want to say radical thoughts about the standards of beauty, you're outspoken about it and you have these conversations. How do you fight that battle internally when you are responsible for something so big?
I fight it daily. I mean, in small ways, and I have been for many, many years. I mean, when I was at Bobbi Brown many years ago, I was the creative director there. I would always look for models when we were casting that were ever so slightly quirky in terms of what we thought of a quirky model was back in the day. And I'll never forget that we used this model once, Susan, who had a gap in her tooth, and she was beautiful. I mean, she was a very traditional beauty girl. But she had a gap in her tooth. And I refused to retouch the gap in her tooth. Absolutely categorically refused, because it was beautiful. And it made her beautiful. And it made her special.
And that girl was in one of the books. I remember, like, Bobby Brown.
She was in the books, right.
Yeah.
But the markets around the world went crazy on me and complained to the president and complained to Bobby and complained to this. And then I went to one of the markets and saw that they had themselves retouched the gap in her tooth. And I was furious, but it's very hard to fight that. I mean, they, and also these are marketing people making creative decisions, which also drives me insane. Today, that would not be an issue. Nobody
right.
would close a gap in anyone's tooth. And you've got girls like Adwa and I can't think of who right now, who are non-traditional beauties and who are who they are. And they are being accepted for who they are. So things have changed in that sense, but it is a battle that I fought over 15 years ago. So I'm glad to see that that's changing. And I continue to maintain that if we hire a model, that model, we have to respect who they are. So for example, Adwa is one of our brand ambassadors at Revlon. We don't retouch her freckles. We don't take off her jewelry. We don't change her hair. We put some makeup on her, and we even are very considerate of what she wants to wear. We don't just hand her a dress and say, put this on. It has to feel right for her. It has to look right on her. And I think those things are now changing. Back in the day, you'd get a model, you're a model, we've hired you. You're a model for rent. You're going to do what we tell you to do.
Right.
And I don't think the brands are thinking that way anymore. I mean, you've got Ashley Graham, who's incredibly outspoken and has changed the game.
Well, all of these people also have their own platforms now. They have their own voices. So if something, they do feel like they were wronged in some way, or their voice was put down, or their identity was put down, they can leave, or they can say something about it. It's not always the easiest thing, but I mean, Ashley has fought a very hard fight for
right.
a very long time.
Right.
And but look at where she is now. So it's important, and you also see the success that comes from it. So I wonder, you are a voice on the inside, and that voice shows through the work that you're putting out. Can you, as a creative director, tell when a brand is putting out something that isn't authentic, but to the consumer's eye, they wouldn't really notice?
Every day I see things, and every day I point out and I scream. And I used to be much more vocal on my social media and just yell at brands and scream at brands and not be considerate of the repercussions of that. So I have to, I've been much more diplomatic recently. I mean, once I went off on Nike, and Nike is one of my favorite brands in the world, and I've worked with them, and I lost it on them, and I did a 10 frame story on something that enraged me. And I got calls from Nike. I got calls from Portland. And, you're a friend of Nike, why would you do such a thing? And I was
like...
But
did they hear you?
They heard me, and, so what it was, I went into the Nike store here on Spring Street with my son. He wanted to buy some sneakers, and I was like, these are cool sneakers, and I love sneakers, I wear sneakers every day, and they didn't have anything in my size in the area where they have the new more interesting shoes. And I was like, well, let me go up to the women's department. And I went up, and as I was coming up the escalator, the wall of shoes was all pink, and I just lost it. And so I took a picture, and I just went crazy on Nike, and was like, Nike, this isn't what we want. Listen to the women. Just because we're female doesn't mean we want pink shoes. Give us options. None of these options downstairs come in my size. And I just, and nothing that I said was incorrect, but it was highly critical of the brand. And I think it's hard for brands to accept criticism from their friends. I think it's very hard. I'm a friend of Nike. I know people there. One of my high school friends, who I've known since I was 12 years old, is a very important person at Nike. And she even called me and she said, well, you could have phrased it differently. And
would you have phrased it differently, though?
No, I wouldn't have, actually. But the most interesting thing about that was I've never received more messages in anything that I've ever done on social media in the 10 years I've been on social media than from that. And I actually kept all of them and sent them to Nike. There were a couple, close to 1,000 responses to that one story. And that's a lot. That's a lot. And every single one of them said the same thing. It was like, thank you for speaking out on something that we've been screaming. And actually, Nike is changing. I do think they're listening. I just think the way I phrased it, and I phrased it apparently so publicly.
Yeah. Well, your Instagram is a very powerful place. It's like, I mean, that's how I found you. And I actually, so my husband Adam sent it to me, and I was like, oh my gosh, these images and the juxtaposition, and this is just so intentional. And it was just very clear that that so much time was put into your feed posts and your stories. And I'm not one to like be like, okay, let's talk about your social media, but let's talk about your social media. How do you, I mean, I'm looking at these books, and obviously a lot of the photos that you're pulling are from things that you've collected in books or that you're looking back up. So how do you decide your approach on social media? How do you decide your approach as a creative director, and what does that process look like?
So I know lots of people ask me about my social media, and it's funny because I'm only beginning to realize, I know this is gonna sound really dumb, that it's very public.
It's not dumb because it doesn't always feel public.
It doesn't feel public.
Sometimes you're just like, you don't realize that there's a human behind every single number.
That's right. And I'm only starting to pay attention to that now, which is why I'm also becoming more diplomatic. But I've always felt that my social media is very personal to me. And it really, if you know me, a lot of it has to do, what am I thinking about right now? Where's my mind going? What kind of visuals? What did I see? What am I interested in? What am I researching? You know, the thing that I find so fascinating is that I love photography and art. And photography is something that I'm really passionate about. I'm not a photographer and I'll never be a photographer, but I love photographers and what they've achieved in the history of art. And I think it's been hugely underrated until quite recently, because a lot of photographers were commercial. You know, Irving Penn, who's one of the greatest photographers of the 20th century, was an advertising guy. But what he did, but he was also, he bridged, he was a painter, he was a true artist in every sense of the word, but he also did advertising. And so I'm really fascinated by that bridge. But what I was trying to say is that you'd think that after 25, 30 years of doing this, I'd know every photographer in the world. And I don't. I just recently discovered a photographer. I actually can't figure out who he is yet. I found a picture recently of LL Cool J. And I was like, this is a beautiful picture. I mean, everything about it is beautiful. Who shot it? And I kind of did my, you know, reverse Google, and I found that there was a I found the first name of the photographer. Can't find the last name of the photographer. Never heard of him. And so to this day, I'm discovering photographers who I've never heard of, who took great pictures because they didn't have good PR, or didn't know how to commercialize, or didn't know how to promote themselves. And to me, that endless dig and the fact that there's still more to discover is hugely fascinating. And that's, a lot of my social media is around that. And also finding something that's relatively bland as a picture, and then putting it in a space that elevates it, I always think is very interesting. But that's also what I do for a living, especially at Revlon. Revlon is the first time I work for a mass brand. I've always worked in luxury or prestige, and Revlon is very mass. It's sold in drugstores. So my big challenge, and what's super interesting to me right now, is how do I take this mass brand and make it aspirational, but not untouchable, but not alienate.
That's the problem you're solving.
That's the problem I'm solving. And it's a difficult problem to solve, actually, because I see it one way, but not everybody who I work with sees it the same way.
Can you give an example?
Well, I mean, they look at other brands that are very successful and they say, well, why aren't we doing this? Because this is super successful. And I'm saying, but if we do this, we just look like every other brand. Why don't we go in this direction and we look different, but we're still addressing all of the needs? And that just means that that's hard to do because not everybody sees what I see. For me, the first thing I see is a visual, but I can't expect everybody around me to think the same way as I think. I'll explain something in a very simple way. I said, but we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it. This is how we're going to create this visual. We're going to put it in a glass of water. For example, we just recently had a shoot where the marketing team wanted to express that this was a clean vegan product. And that's very important for the consumer today. So they came up with all these ideas where they're like, well, you know, they're very obvious direction is, well, put it with some leaves or some fruits. And that's what they see. It's a very kind of first level thing, but they're not from my industry. They're from the marketing industry. And I'm like, no, I don't think we should do that, because if we do, the consumer is going to perceive food. They're going to perceive we're like harvesting, you know, organic vegetables. And that's not what we're trying to say. So it's a lot of back and forth, a lot of back and forth and a lot of convincing. And then sometimes I just say yes and then go off and do something else and then bring it back and say, see. And that was exactly what happened this week. I went off, I work with Raymond Meyer, who's an extraordinary photographer and who's a has an incredibly creative mind and is a creative director of in his own world. And I respect that. If we can have two creative directors, that's better than one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what we did is we created an image of water and flowers, which doesn't necessarily say vegan, but it automatically says clean and nature without going into the vegetable world. So it's that kind of thing that I constantly struggle with. There's a very kind of, this is how, you know, this is a very first degree point of view on how we should be addressing certain messages. And my job is to take them somewhere else, but it's not easy. It's not often easy.
You self-identify as more of a shy person.
Yes.
But the images that you create are far from shy.
Correct. But that's because I'm sitting behind a computer.
That's a very honest thing to say. But so to me, it's just like,
it's not me. It's just that there's a wall between me, the person, and those visual, or us, or so I think. I mean,
that's a story you told yourself.
That's a story I've told myself, and that's a story I choose to believe because that's my comfort zone.
Right. Well, so then in this process, how would you tell somebody to find their voice? Because sometimes I think we think voice is in this communication, but obviously you're a visual storyteller, so you find your voice through visuals.
Right.
How would you tell someone to find their personal voice?
I think it's find what you like. Find what you're passionate about. I always tell people to find what they're passionate about, because if you have passion, that can be turned into a purpose very easily. And I tell kids that all the time. I have a great example of this kid who I didn't know at all, was sending me lots of DMs. I want to work with you. I want to work with you. I want to work with you. How can I work with you? And I'm looking at him. I'm like, listen, dude, I don't know what to tell you. I work at Revlon. It's a very corporate environment. We have a very small design team. I need strong designers. And he just would not let this go. He just wouldn't stop. And he would just keep sending me messages. Finally, I was like, I'm going to call your bluff. Come in and meet with me. And I try to meet people outside the office because it makes them more comfortable. It's a very hard for young kids to come into this very corporate environment. And I sit in a very corporate part of the office. But I had him come into the office. I was like, you know what? I'm going to show you what you're dealing with. He sat in my office. He came with a skateboard in his hand. He skateboarded to the office, sat in my office. And he said, I want to be a graphic designer. And I was like, okay, well, show me what you've got. Well, I don't have a portfolio. I'm like, okay, so have you ever designed anything in your life? And he's like, not really. I kind of worked at this company, but they let me go because they don't have any money. And I was like, well, what did you study? Psychology. I'm like, well, do you know how to use the software? And he's like, yeah, I know how to use the software. I'm like, have you ever designed anything in your life? He's like, well, here's a few things I've designed. And it was very rudimentary. But there was something about that kid. He was so passionate, and he was just not taking no for an answer at all, that I hired him as a freelancer. And this was just under a year ago, and he's still there, and he's a great designer. He's a great designer. He's now working with one of the most senior designers, assisting him, and he's a great designer, and he works his ass off. He comes every day with a skateboard or his bike, and he's sitting there, and it's so funny to see him because he just doesn't look like anyone else. He is a great designer. And that is an example of somebody who was just passionate and wasn't going to take no for an answer and knew what he wanted to go, and he turned that into, he's going to be a designer forever.
But should he have come to you with a portfolio or some other designs?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. I'm not that formal. You know, sometimes you can feel things. The thing is with him is in that specific moment, you know, I got to Revlon 2 years ago, and it's a company that is, you know, reconfiguring how it works. It used to work with outside agencies, and now we're trying to bring more things in-house. So that to me means we have to bring very strong people. Because, you know, when you replace a big agency with hundreds of people with a small design team, you need strong designers.
Right.
So my inclination is not to hire somebody who doesn't know how to design. My inclination is to find somebody really good. So I went against that simply because this kid was just not going to take no for an answer. Just wasn't having it. And he was so adamant that no matter what I threw at him, he was going to do it, that I had to give him a chance. And, you know, it was a small risk for us because, you know, we weren't hiring him as a full-time employee. It was sort of you're here to assist, you know, five or six other people. The risk was very low. But he proved me completely wrong, and he was completely right. And it really does come from his absolute passion and what he wanted to do. He didn't study it, but he knew that that's what he wanted to do. But what's crazy about that is he's a skateboarder, and I believe there's a massive correlation between kids who skateboard and art. When you look at how many skateboarders are filmmakers or photographers or artists or illustrators, there's a correlation there. Somebody needs to do a study on that. Somebody needs to write a thesis.
Is that our
on
next story?
Wow. There's something about that. Look at Mark Gonzalez. Look at Ed Templeton. All these guys come from skateboarding, but they've all developed other massive careers outside of skateboarding that are all art-based.
That's so amazing. That's amazing. I mean, that's an amazing correlation, and I'm happy you brought it to my attention, but also is just a testament to the fact that you pick up all of the little things along the way.
I've been doing this for a really long time. And it's funny because there was an Instagram post recently, somebody who I didn't know posted about the demise of French Glamour. One of my first jobs was working for French Glamour in Paris. And apparently they just shut it down this week or something. And so somebody wrote about, the end of French Glamour, and credited all the people who had worked there. But sort of, I was only there for, I think, 2 years or a year and a half with Robin Derrick, who was really my mentor, who was the person who really kind of helped propel me into this industry when I graduated from art school. And then I corrected the post. I said, but actually, the first creative director, art director, was Robin Derrick. And I tagged him. And this entire, I don't know how many messages are on there right now. And there's this whole storytelling that's happening where Robin is like, well, remember when we did this? And remember when we did this? And remember? And all sorts of things that I didn't actually remember, some that I did remember, that tell the story of this, the beginning of this magazine, that is just brilliantly fascinating and that nobody ever knows because we don't tell our stories. Graphic designers and art directors tell other people's stories. We don't tell our stories. And then I realized, I was like, wait, there's a story here that we should somehow tell, but graphic designers don't tell their stories. My job, good graphic design or good art direction or good creative direction is invisible.
I've heard that before.
It's true.
And people around the world obviously notice it. It's still a rewarding thing.
It's a very rewarding thing. I like to make things and put them out there. And if they're successful, that's even better. You know, Revlon's has actually allowed me to take risks. I mean, I made this film last year based on a photograph, actually. So there's this photograph that I've always loved from a female Chilean photographer, and it's this line of girls, little girls lined up on a ballet bar. And one of them is like lifted up her skirt so you could see her butt, and the other one is like upside down, and all the other ballet girls are very sort of standing properly. And I looked at this picture and I was like, this is kind of amazing because ballet is a very rigorous discipline. And then you've got these girls who don't care. Like they're in their ballet tutus and whatever, but and so I was like, well, shout out to all the women who step out of line. Mm. And that became a film for Revlon, just from this one picture, which we put out last year, which is on YouTube, and it's got millions of views, which is amazing to me because it's a very non-conventional film for a beauty brand.
I love that.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, it's one of the best things I've ever worked on because it's very based on beauty, but it's based on beauty in the way that I think we should be looking at beauty. So,
well, I enjoy looking at beauty through your lens.
Well, it's very, thank you for saying that, but it's very non-traditional.
No, I mean, I think that people appreciate that a lot today. The one question I ask to end every interview.
Yeah.
I always like to try to segue to it, but so interesting that you say, you know, graphic designers, creative directors, they tell other people's stories, not really theirs. And so it's always easier to segue this question through your own story, but you've been like telling so many other stories throughout this conversation. But the question is just, how is your heart doing these days?
Well.
You're like, well, interview part two.
Yeah, well, we're living in very scary times.
Yeah.
I'm very curious what's going to happen this year. 2020 is a very important year for the world because we're looking at a U.S. election, but U.S. elections affect the world globally.
Yeah.
And I do think that it's very unpredictable what can happen. And I do think it's very worrying. I think that politically what has happened in the last 4 years is not good for the world. My heart is a little fearful and anxious, but also cautiously optimistic because I think the world does rectify. There's rectifications that happen, and I'm hoping that the world will rectify. And you know, we're in Corona land. We're in Corona, and I think that is very. I think what's happening, what I'm seeing happening in the world or in America, not necessarily in the world, because I think the other parts of the world are dealing with it very differently. I think that's going to be a game changer for this election year. So my heart is anxious, but from a very personal level, I mean, we're healthy. We have, you know, my kids are healthy. I still get to make beautiful things on occasion. And I live in New York City, which is a really amazing place to live because it's incredibly inspirational. So it's, my heart is cautiously optimistic.
I love that. Thank you, Rova.
You're welcome.
This episode was produced by myself, Alice Cottle, Lindsay Blum, Hannah Park, Adam Kafif. Audio and sound engineering by Seth Feingersh. Creative direction by Shawnee Pleasance. Shot and edited by Tom Huerta and Stefan Lawrence. The soundtrack to this episode is produced by Portugal the Man. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, then talk to a stranger today and let us know what that process was like. You can do so by hitting me up on social media. All of my handles are at N-O-O-R, except for Twitter, which is N-T-A-G-O-U-R-I. Yes, I have a last name. And if you're in the U.S. or Canada, you can text me at the number 301-246-8894. Yes, it's really me. I can't wait to hear about your experiences. And of course, don't forget to subscribe.